This episode of Perspectives on Prevention was recorded live at the Prevention and Early Intervention Network Summit in Limerick in September 23. I chat with Joe Slattery about trauma, parenting, and why men need to show vulnerability. Listeners should note that this episode includes sensitive subject matter and an instance of swearing.
Our next guests are, just a note to the programme, Joe Slattery from the North Star Project has very kindly filled in a short notice for Mags Casey, who couldn't be here. So thank you very much for that, Joe. So Joe will be in conversation with Marion Quinn, who is the CEO of CDI Tala, and they're going to talk about the space between lived experience and prevention and early intervention for the next while. So I'll hand over to you guys when you're ready.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Wow, look at you all. Isn't it exciting to be here? It's fabulous. So welcome, everybody, to this first live episode of Perspectives on Prevention, which is the podcast series of the Prevention Early Intervention Network. And it is fabulous to be here in Thomond Park and to see all of you with us. And I am really pleased that I'm going to be chatting with Joe Slattery, a local Limerick guy from South Hill. So we will have time for questions and answers at the end. So, you know, just be thinking about those so that we're not wasting time. Joe.
Yes.
Good to have you here. Thank you for joining us.
It's an honour to be here. I'm delighted to be here today.
Joe, tell us about growing up in South Hill.
Obviously, everyone has their own different story and their own experiences of growing up in South Hill. But for us, it kind of started within the family of, you know, there was a major car crash in the family when my parents were very young. My father in his early 20s, also my mother, three kids in tow. Both parents came from disadvantaged areas as well. So obviously, even just the complexities of coming together and starting a family can be very stressful for anyone. But that incident really set our family into turmoil. My father lost both his legs. My mother went out through the window. The family was separated for months at a time. So you can only imagine the psychological damage that created for a young man in his 20s with a family of who is he now and what is he going to be and who is he going to become and how will the relationship be. And I can look back now and as a professional and make an assumption of this is some of the stuff that went on, you know. But then, you know, my mother, being the amazing woman she is, had to firefight everything. You know, so she had to take care of three kids, take care of a man in turmoil, but also while she was already a broken woman herself through her accident and trying to recover from that. So that created a house that was full of tension, full of anxiety, full of fear, full of anger. And because of all those things, and, you know, keeping us fed, keeping the house clean, making sure we went to school, our uniforms, all that kind of stuff, there wasn't much time for the lovey-dovey stuff. You know, there just wasn't space for it because of all the crisis. So as a young person, that environment was very difficult for me. I am a real softy. I love affection, I love cuddles, you know. Of course, they weren't available for many different reasons. So I spent as much time as I could outside the house, which meant I was in Limerick in South Hill. And at that time, the 80s and 90s, you know, the noughties, as the generations went on, it turned into a very volatile environment. Simply having too many people together with disadvantage, single moms, early school education, and maybe a lot of people living on the social welfare. So, you know, it was very chaotic. And sadly, obviously, drugs come in, and that's great thing for a society that's in disadvantage, isn't it? Because when you can take drugs and mask your pain and try and disguise yourself from the world you're living in, but also it was a great way for making money for people who felt they had no options other than this is how I'll make money because I won't get a job, I'm going to be on the dole, I'm not clever, I'm not educated. So obviously people started selling and taking drugs, which created an implosion of violence between people. So living in that environment, it was very much people were on, it was at some points it was like a war zone. So that fight or flight mode, a lot of people, especially young men, were in that environment, and simply because it was fear-based. So it was, you were triggered very easily into violence of simply of who are you looking at, what did you say, people ended up dead from that. It was really tragic, you know. But at the time, because of such a small area, you can imagine the tension it caused, because not only did someone lose their life, the person who took the life more than likely lived in that area as well. So over a period of maybe 10 or 15 years, there was a lot of murders. A lot of people went to prison, caused a lot of families to rift between each other. And even as a young person, you might have known these families, and their younger brothers and sisters might have been my friends. And now you're kind of torn between, well, whose side do I take here? Because I can't be friends with Bodhi, you know? So you're left with all this turmoil. And that's a difficult place for a young man, young woman to be, you know?
And yet, Joe, you didn't kind of take that path of either using or selling drugs, getting involved in the violence. So how did you manage to take a different path?
That's not actually true. I did.
Oh, well, you didn't tell me that.
No, I didn't tell you that. So my coping mechanism was I didn't know how to cope. So I took drugs for many years, drank at a very young age, started smoking cigarettes before I can remember my mother telling me these stories about my grandfather giving me roll-ups and I'll sort him out. I don't remember my grandfather. I never met him. He died when I was a kid. So since a very young age, I've been self-destructing. Drinking and smoking weed pretty much my entire teenage years, which now my teenage years are quite foggy because of it, you know. But I needed to. It's the only way I could cope with living in that environment. You know, and I'm not trying to cause any kind of hysteria, but potentially I might have killed myself if I hadn't those escape mechanisms that I needed because I couldn't cope in the life that I was living in, you know. Luckily, fingers crossed, it never led into serious crime or anything like that. And the one thing my family always were brought up with was morals for our community. So I was always respectful to my neighbours. You know, I never done anything like that. I just self-imploded. You know, I really kind of damaged myself. Didn't necessarily want to damage anybody else. But that, you know, that probably also kept me alive.
Yeah. And the work ethic, Joe, we chatted a bit last night about how you got into employment and began to kind of progress very quickly, and it seemed like there was a very strong work ethic that kind of enabled that. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the background from our families was you don't go on the dole, you work, and you know, if I wanted something in the house, if I needed new runners, then okay, you have to clean the windows or do whatever, nothing was handed to you. And for my father, before he left, he lost his legs. If you needed money, he'd go cleaning windows, he'd cut grass. He was an uneducated man who wasn't afraid of work, so all the work was labouring kind of work. So we were brought up with that attitude. My mother has been a career cleaner her entire life, never stopped working, you know. So the attitude is if you want something, you have to go and work and get it. So that stood to me. And then when I was probably 8 or 9, we got horses. Actually, I got a donkey. My father got me a donkey. And that was a pivotal change in my life because the having the horses actually created a space for me to release all my hurt, my pain, my frustrations. And that's one of the reasons, like I think of some of my friends now, and some of them are dead, some are in heavy addiction, some never matured past actually playing PlayStations and drinking every night. And I was like, well, why didn't I end up to that severe? And one of the main reasons is I had horses to release my tension to. So to me, my horse was my best friend. My donkey was my best friend. And I could cry and I could laugh and I could talk to him. I would never talk to an adult that way. Even in the home, you wouldn't show vulnerability. You would have been seen as a weakness. And you know, at the time with my friends, taken in perspective of that time, if you were any bit vulnerable, you'd be slagged, going, oh, you're a faggot or this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? That you'd have to deal with. So you had to pretend you were someone you were not. But that work ethic always stood to me. I was a career cleaner for years. I used to even clean in slaughterhouses and then I'd be on building sites. And everything that was not where you didn't need your mentality for, it was just physical. I was strong. I didn't mind working. But if you said I'd have to go into an environment where I'd have to intellectually use my brain or anything like that, then I would have scared away from it because my idea of myself was I was stupid and I was no good. And, you know, I can work like a donkey, but that's as far as it would go, you know. And then I got a job in Dell Computers, and for a lot of people they hated it, but I loved it, you know, because I was a workhorse. So very quickly I went through pressing buttons into like a line leader role to the supervisor role, and then I had to go to meetings, and then I'd send emails. And of course I got kicked out of school at 16 with a failed junior cert. I had nothing, so I had no grammar. I still thought I was stupid, but I slowly started saying, okay, I need to learn this stuff. And then you're around a lot of different people outside of South Hill. So up to that point, my tunnel vision was living in South Hill. I only knew people from South Hill. And the attitude was everyone, there was an angle. So if someone was doing you a favor, it was behind the scenes, you were getting screwed in one way or another. So this was my mentality of the world, that everyone was there to screw you over. But then I started working there, and that wasn't the case. And I went to New York, you know, went to New York on the holidays, really hated it. It was for the Millennium New Year's Eve. But I went back there about 2 years later, and I spent 5 years working over there with, of course, all the Irish, different kind of people. Do you need a job? Yeah, I do. Yeah, I'll give you a job. I was like waiting for the backlash, but there was none. Do you need an apartment? Yeah, there was an apartment. So all this stuff was given to you, and people were just willing you on for no other reason. So my view of people and the world changed kind of at that point, you know. Mm.
And tell us about the vulnerability, Joe. Yeah. So being afraid to show vulnerability, do you think that that's something that still exists for young men? And how did that manifest for you? And how can we support people and young people to be able to sort of share that vulnerability?
I think men need to mirror vulnerability to other men. A woman said to me a couple of years back that Irish men had their hearts closed. And that makes sense to me. You know, the attitude is, you're crying, don't cry now, and don't show emotions. And sadly, that was a lot of way for a lot of men. I do think we're now coming into an age where vulnerability is okay, expressing emotions is okay, and is not seen as a weakness. But I think the more we can mirror that man to a man and parent to your children, as opposed to saying, shh, be quiet, no, it's fine, don't say that in public, or don't show your emotions in public. That's, you know, that's really sending a message that you're not supposed to express how you're feeling. And that does a lot of damage, you know. That vulnerability, for me, I think it was very common, you know. And I think about that sometimes when your parents are saying, oh, he's with the wrong crowd, you know. And I think about that a lot. But everyone in that crowd is probably with the wrong crowd. But why do we gravitate towards each other? Because we're comfortable in our discomfort of each other. So most of the people that I grew up, bar maybe a handful of three or four, I wouldn't trust them as far as I throw them. But yet I spent days with them, hanging out with them, drinking with them, getting in trouble with them, didn't trust them one bit. Why? I felt comfortable in that uncomfortableness, you know, and none of us showed emotion to each other. But that was okay to live like that, you know. And I look at my son now, he's 22, he lives away. I was bringing him somewhere in a car one day with his friends in the back, and they were talking about their insecurities. They were talking about the shyness of meeting girls. And I was in the front and I was thinking, wow, we never had that growing up. You would never have that conversation. And I'm so touched by them and so proud of them that they were so close in their vulnerability. And I hope society is now coming that way. But when you grow up in a harder environment where it's fight or flight, you have to understand it was a war zone. A war zone, a lot of people's families' homes because of who might come in the door, if there's drugs going on, if there's drinking going on, if there's abuse in the family, you're constantly in a war zone. Out in the environment, we were constantly in war zones because at any given time, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time and people got murdered. It got to the stage where death now doesn't shock me. It still makes me sad, but I'm not shocked by it anymore because you've experienced so much of it and been part of families who experienced so much of it. It actually became more really normalised, which is really actually weird to say, but it just became part of the environment, you know.
So, Joe, thinking about your childhood and young adulthood and your peers, and so we talked a little bit about last night about a lot of your peers are either they're dead or, you know, they've had very difficult lives. You got the donkey when you were 8.
Yeah, yeah.
What might have changed the path for some of your peers, do you think?
Somewhere to vent openly and honestly. I don't know if they had that, whether it was a person or another living being. I think a lot of them didn't have that. And a lot of them, you know, even though my family home was difficult, I kind of look at their family homes as even being far more difficult and far more complex, and some of the abuse they experienced was devastating, you know. So they're on a losing battle from the very start. And now, some have really excellent lives and are really happy themselves. Others, sadly, didn't, you know. And I look at that sometimes, but And then it's, it can be down to coping skills, it can be down to personality, it can be down to temperament, it can be down to our ability to be resilient and cope in different areas, you know. Because we're all unique and we're all different. So even within a family home and you have these siblings and you're mirroring one after the other, it's a really bad thing to do because they're all unique and all very complex. So maybe it was just, fingers crossed, maybe I was just lucky. You know, maybe I had the right people at the right time to help me kind of have that hope that things could change, you know.
The experience of feeling that you were stupid, because again, that's sort of something you've mentioned a few times. So tell us about where that came from.
Well, who's the most influential people in your life but your parents at those earlier ages? So it was my parents. You know, you're taking, you know, it would be, I mean, even you're a stupid cunt. This is it, you know. And it wasn't actually, I don't think there was any venom behind it, but that was the language that was used. That was the language that they were taught on how you respond to situations. And like I said, you know, obviously I don't want to create a bad image about my parents. They're actually really good parents, but you have to understand the devastation that they were going through in their own lives and their inability then to maybe have a balanced view. So, you know, everything was responsive and reactive and you're triggered very quickly because they were also heightened in a certain way. So I would hear that on a regular basis and, of course, I believed it, you know. And then you'd hear from other peers living in South Hill who parents thought these parents of, like, oh, don't put South Hill on your address now, you'll never get a job. So then you, that's compounded that I live in a certain area that no one will like you, so you're useless that way, you know. So when I went to school, I never tried in school, I dosed in school, I messed around, and, you know, I only got into secondary school because actually I got a belt of wood in primary school, and my mother said, if you don't get him in, I'm going to sue the school. So that's the way I got in. And I remember going in doing the altitude test, and just going ABCD, and the same with my junior cert. I got kicked out 6 months before my junior cert, came back to do my junior cert, and went in, I'd say I spent 10 minutes in there, and left again, didn't even try. And as an adult, I really regret that now, because now I have a master's, you know, that I got after 30 years of age. And I kind of look back now and say, God, if I actually try, I wonder what I would have got. I wonder if I tried then. You know, so it did. It come from that environment. It come from being told by many people I was. It came from teachers that didn't understand I was in pain and I was hurting and I was lashing out and kind of damaged me by, you know, kind of being verbally abusive as well, or not putting any concept to understand what I was going through, you know, other than you're tick and you'll be nothing and all this usual stuff that you get, you know.
And how has all of that experience kind of shaped you as a parent? So you've got three children, two boys and a girl, and so what? How has that informed your style of parenting?
The best thing that happened to me when I met my wife, she had two boys. I was still fairly damaged. You know, I was working in this area, but I was working through my scars and going to counseling, doing all the personal development and stuff. But I was in the middle of doing a course in Bedford Row. It was a 2-year course in family support and crisis intervention. So, and I had never been with a person who had children first. Now, I was always family oriented. I always want kids. So I was always conscious. I didn't want to get involved with someone who had kids, realize it wasn't going to work out, and then leave. So, you know, and I had this course, and it was a lot of personal development, and the people in the course I was very open with, and I was trying to figure out, is this lust or love? You know, what am I getting into here, you know? Because I had made a few mistakes before it, of that wounded warrior of actually finding people who were as damaged as I was, thinking I could fix them, so I wasn't going to do that anymore. So we could explore all that, and I was like, no, this girl is for me, you know. But at that time, I still would have the mentality of, you'll do as you're told, you'll speak when you're spoken to, and I'm the father, you'll do as you say, be seen and not heard. But I started training and delivering the Strength and Family programs, which is an early intervention program, and it changed my whole view on how you communicate with people, how you respond to people. And thankfully, this happened at the same time when I got into that relationship and those kids came into my life. So it got me, it allowed me to change my response to them. And even times when I messed up and I might spit out something because I've been stressed, I was able to go back and say, I'm really sorry, that was actually all on me, and I'm sorry I done that. Or when they come with this crazy suggestion of something they want to do, instead of saying, well, cop on, you're just like, okay, if you can give me a reason of how that will work and that makes sense to me, come back to me and we'll discuss it. So most times it don't come back, you know. Or I can say, you know, that was really a bad move. That wasn't a good thing to do, but I still love you. So I can be very open with my kids and express compassion. I love hugging, you know, and we can sit down and have conversations. No, we're not the Waltons. They don't exist. We have arguments in our house. wee shout, and there was like, sometimes there was like, just get out of my face, you know. And I think that's normal enough, but the balance of love and compassion and confidence and compliments far outweigh the negative. They're healthy kids. I remember one day sitting at the table with them after doing, it was another parenting program, and at the end of the session he said, who do you appreciate and why? So we all said, of course, I picked my wife and my kids. And we went home then to have dinner, and we were sitting at a table, and I said, I want to just have a little thing of, why do we appreciate each other, you know? And my stepson at the time was about 13 or 14, and he said, I really appreciate Joe because he's fair with me. And I would have thought I was really strict with him. And by creating that conversation, I learned actually he's okay. So I learned how to communicate better. I learned how to be open that I'm not. Sometimes I get it wrong, and I continued having horses, and me and myself would suddenly go horse riding up the mountains or whatever, and I used to take those times to talk to them, and I used not without giving them all the details I've given you today, but you know that there was difficulties there and some difficulties with my father, and sometimes I get it wrong, and sometimes I say stuff I don't mean, but you know I love you, and because we're not face to face, he could hear it in a way that wasn't intimidating, you know.
Great. Joe, we're going to move to questions and answers in just a moment, so if people want to think about any questions you might have. But just to go back to your childhood.
Yes.
So you talk about, even into your adulthood, still being in pain, still being broken, despite the donkey. What were the missed opportunities for you in your childhood? When looking back, what are the places where you think, if only I'd had support there, or if only somebody had stepped in, what were those moments that would have made a difference?
It's hard to tell because they've kind of passed, you know. But I tell you, once I'm 46 now, but when I turned 40, I really don't care what people think anymore. And I went into a drama group, and we done drama, we done musicals, I joined a choir. I'd done all these things that I couldn't have done as a child because I would have got slated, you know. Probably would have got beat up for it, you know. Well, I would have got beat up for it. So, I got to be able to express myself. And I think, you know, if the things were changed when I was younger, I would have expanded my wings. I would have met other people. I would have went on dates. I would have went into different environments and maybe broadened my variety a lot quicker. But the mental attitude of living in South Hill that you won't be accepted anywhere else and no one will want to know you kind of prevented me from doing that, kind of being who I wanted to be, you know. But there was influential people in my life. Larry DeClaire from Bedford Row. I met Larry as a youth worker in South Hill. He used to take me fishing, camping, all those kind of things. And even at the time, like, let's just say it didn't have a massive impact because I was still caught up in the crisis of my life. But I met Larry later in life and I came back and started volunteering in Bedford Row, and that's where I started my career for the last 15 years working in family intervention and family crisis. So meeting Larry as a young boy planted that seed that I can trust this man. He's a good man. He's good to be around. So when I saw him later in life, I didn't think twice about saying, Larry, can I come and volunteer in your service? He put me into counselling, he put me into personal development, he mentored me, he guided me, he made me aware that I hadn't dealt with my issues, you know. All those scars were still there, really open and raw, but I'd done a great job of hiding them. And if I'm going to be totally honest, it wasn't until I went and done the Masters a couple of years back, where I finally got rid of that imposter syndrome. So even though I was in it, talking the talk, I still think sooner or later I'm going to be found out. Sooner or later, I really don't know. But of course I did. But what I realised is the childhood, the inner child was still dominating the man. So the decisions I was making as a man, as a professional, were still being influenced by this scared, insecure boy who's going to be found out. And through all the counselling that I had to do in that Masters, I figured that out. That I was still being led by the boy, and I separated him out. I'm not led by him anymore. I'm really good at what I do, you know, and it's because I educated myself and worked in it for the last 10 or 11 years. I never stopped. So the evidence is actually I should know what I'm doing. And once I realized that, it really freed me up. Now, insecurities happen every now and again, but like I said, that's the boy. Let's deal with the man, you know. So
great. Okay, thanks, Joe. We're going to take a couple of questions. So Susan has the microphone. If you can stand up and tell us who you are and where you're from and then ask your question and try and keep it fairly tight so we can get a few in. Any hands up for a question? Okay, Jennifer, thank you.
Hello. Thanks a million, Joe and Marion. Jennifer from Alcohol Action Ireland. I guess, Joe, you kind of spoke brilliantly about all of the themes, I guess, of childhood trauma, mental health, substance use. It's kind of all in there. And I suppose, you know, we have all of the research now that tells us, you know, what childhood trauma does across the lifespan, and we have all the lived experience stories, but we still aren't very good at kind of joining all of those dots and kind of connecting people's problems back to whatever, you know, the trauma was. And I suppose from all your years and your lived experience, I suppose why or what, I guess this is a huge question, but what do you think, how do you think we can join the dots better, and how do you think we can get the message to government to that these are the kind of the core things that need to be solved, I suppose, within mental health services or family services or child services or whatever it is. So, yeah, that's a big question. Sorry.
No, it is, but it also isn't, because it's very simple. Is there still a real lack of understanding of the trauma-informed care approaches to join up with the behaviour of a person? So we look at behaviour of an adult or a child, and we judge them on their behaviour. We still lack the ability to be curious of what's going on for that person and why are they doing what they're doing, as opposed to how dare you do that in front of me. Whether that's the school setting, whether it's in a professional setting or in someone's office, we take personal offence that you would dare do that or say that to me. It's nothing to do with you. And if you can kind of ask yourself, and one of the first things I learned, and I carried a long time, is when I learned that in Bedford Row, is when someone's in front of you and they've went through so many different things, if you can ask yourself, say, what happened from the time they come out of their mother's womb to the time they're standing in front of you? What happened during that timeline that this is the choices they've made and the outcomes they've come up with? If you can't have compassion, have curiosity, but please don't have judgment. Please don't have criticism. And please, if you're biased, go and work on your stuff, because that says more about you than it does about the person that you're working with. And we're still far behind on that. There's a lot of professionals across all different sectors who are not trained in trauma-informed. And even more importantly, they're not trained to be aware of their own biases and their own personal issues. I've been in many places advocating on, you know, even here you take Moy Ross, you take South Hill, a lot of people have horses, and it's really badly kind of viewed upon. But I'm saying to you is, you take those horses away from those boys and girls, how are they going to vent? What are they going to do with their time? It's the same as you going playing tennis or playing golf or doing art. They're de-stressing themselves. So, you know, and you look at it now and it kind of bothers me, but I'm also happy. It's like Castlereagh Prison. I'd love to shake the hand of the committee that put the horse project up there, but that should have been in these communities, and then maybe they wouldn't have ended up in Castlereagh. You know, it's that early. Do it early. Mm-hmm. And not your opinion of what should be in the state. I was in a meeting recently where someone made an opinion of what should be in the housing estate, when that housing estate is full of scramblers and full of horses, and what they wanted to put in just didn't relate. And I'm thinking in my head, looking blankly, saying, it's not about you or what you want. You're not listening to the people, you know. Listen. Mm-hmm. And be understandable.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Anybody else want to ask a question? You need to do it now quickly because we've got a lot of time. Thank you. Great. Just say who you are and where you're from. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Brendan McNamara. I work with Exeter. I'm from Limerick, born and bred and proud. And it goes, this one of the questions, Joe, and being from South Hill, I'm disloyalty. Do you think that the idea of being disloyal to where you come from and your family has an effect on You came to realisation at one stage, you know, when you did your master's. And I see sometimes when we're working with people who work in, we live in certain communities, the idea of being disloyal to that community, that you can't be seen to do things, you can't be seen to offend them, to work against them. I'm one of them, I'll always be one of them. How did that impact on you? Was there a time when you said, you know, I can move on from this now. I'm not being disloyal.
No, because I don't think I am disloyal. I think right now what I'm doing is advocating for what people went through and trying to create an understanding that people don't have of what it's like to grow up in a disadvantaged, violent area, with the hope that people will be more compassionate and understanding towards people's actions, you know. I am a proud man from South Hill. You know, it is what I said is what it was from my experience of being there, you know. As I grew and as I changed, yes, I stepped away from people because it was for my wellness to do that. I love them just as much. And this is family and friends, you know. I have hope for them. But being in that environment because I expanded and grew myself means I had to distance from different people. But I think everybody should do that. Be around people who are positive and an influence in your life. And if they're not, step away. You know, but I think more, it can be an attitude when you grow up in an environment that's a house full of secrecy. Don't say anything outside this door. No one needs to know our business. And then that's a core value you've received, so that expands other parts of your life, you know. But that's usually a house that where there's stuff, unhealthy kind of behaviours going on, like, you know. I don't think by expanding and moving on you're being disloyal. You, as long as you're carrying the message, I think, in an honest and positive way, you know.
Okay, thanks. That's an interesting question, Brendan. We've time for one more. Anybody else for a question? Is there a hand up? No? No? Okay. All right. Joe, any sort of final thoughts from you then about what we can all do collectively? So, I mean, we've heard about your personal journey a little bit. Obviously, you've got an extensive sort of professional experience and insights as well. So combining both of those two things, what can we all do to prevent, you know, the young man that you were still carrying all of that trauma? How can we all help the young guy that doesn't get the donkey?
It's a big question. I suppose the one thing I've learned over the years is the lack of interagency, different services actually working together. I think there's still a lot of professional snobbery out there, where, and especially between the voluntary sector and the people within those communities and people from academic sides of everyone thinking they know what's best, no one actually collaborating, working really together, listening to the voice of the community that's supposed to be. For me, the expert on the person is the person. You give them time, you give them space, you create a safety place, they will become who they're supposed to be. Your agenda for them is really not important. And that's my mantra when I work with people all the time, saying, I now work for you. How can I help you? What do you need from me? You know? And if you can groom with that attitude of, you now work for those people. Like if you work in the HSC work for the community. They're not there to serve you, you're there to serve them. And if you really are honest and authentic about that, you will make changes. If you're going in there with a kind of an attitude that I know best of what goes on in your life, it's really insulting for one, it's really offensive, and all you're doing is disempowering a person to be the best they can be. Give them the space, give them the encouragement to become who they need to be. And that's your early intervention. Because from my attitude of you're no good and you become nothing, if I had someone in the background saying, actually you're really good, you know, you really have potential, you really could do this, I would gravitate it towards that, you know? So be that person.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you so much. You're listening to Perspectives on Prevention. To subscribe to our podcast, go to Nearcast, Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. So we're here at the Prevention and Early Intervention Network Summit, and I'm going to check in with people to see what they have been hearing and what struck them from the input so far today.
My name is Fergal Andy, and I'm the CEO of the Family Resource Centre National Forum. I suppose my highlights are so far are just to be in Limerick, to be in Thomond Park, to meet a lot of people who I haven't seen in a long time, to make new connections. In terms of the content, I suppose, to me there's an emerging theme coming across a lot of the presentations around what I would call community development, that we don't have all the answers. That as interested professionals, organisations, academics, we have a contribution to make, but that contribution can't be made without listening to communities first. I thought Joe made that point really well. I thought Maria brought it back up later again. And I think, I mean, there's been lots of interesting content. I think John Canavan brought it in as well, and Liz Canavan. And I think if we can somehow bottle that, as to use Liz's term, and take it away, and how we can take all our expertise and knowledge, but bring it to communities, listening to them in the first instance with humility, and starting where communities are at. And I think it's something that Marion has talked about as well in relation to TALA and the work of CDI. And the way I understand that is sort of place-based community development first, and then comes the evidence, and then comes the expertise, and then comes the professional interventions after that. And it's important we recognise that sequence.
Joe Power, restorative practice development officer, and just really appreciating the chance to meet a lot of people. This is new to me, this network is new to me still, but it's the importance of early intervention, obviously well known to everyone here, but it's kind of, I suppose, redoubling the efforts in my own mind, and things like targeting politicians. I think I'm going to target the next politician I meet. That's one little thing I picked up.
I'm Linda Hughes from Barnardo's, and what I've heard, I suppose, is that I suppose early intervention matters to everybody, that everybody's got a part to play, from that sort of practice frontline piece to that sort of more political agenda and what we can do about it. And I think it's about, we talk about interagency work, which I think sometimes we think about as being cross peers. And actually, I think today we really got people talking to each other. And that, to me, is what this conference is about, is people on the ground being able to talk to people who maybe have some political influence and vice versa, that we get a bit of crosstalk, that the interagency talking is actually up and down the line as well as across.
Sinead Hickey, Prevention Partnership and Family Support in Tusla and Limerick. I suppose what I've been really taken by this morning is the last conversation and listening to Liz Canavan's approach around that whole government approach and needing to embed PEI in the whole government approach. And I think that's really, really essential. I also like the fact that we're thinking about how policy impacts on what lands on the front line. Often the partnership approaches, the working together, the collaboration works really easily on the front line, but it's that leadership from whole of government and from different departments. And I suppose, I think conferences like this encourage that discussion and open up that forum to have further discussion, because I think, you know, the front line really need that leadership from whole government, and prevention, early intervention needs to be on every table across the spectrum of services.
John Sherry from Parents Plus. I really enjoyed this morning your interview with Joe, and that personal experience of being a parent, trying to access services as you grow up, and then the real challenge that is, and then him able to reflect about it as a practitioner. I found that quite interesting.
I'm Lulu O'Kelly, the Acting Coordinator for Specs in Bray, and I have to say, yes, what John said earlier, I thought Joe was amazing. I thought his story was so passionate, and it was just so nice to hear from the parents' perspective.
Bernie Laverty, the National ABC Project Manager in Tusla, and I suppose I'm just loving the buzz. It's the first conference we've had in a while, but also with that prevention early intervention focus, is we're hearing kind of the history of prevention and early intervention. We've achieved a lot, but what we need to do to make it more kind of mainstream across state agencies, government, etc., etc.
Thanks for listening to Perspectives on Prevention. We hope we've inspired you and given you something to think about. If you want to suggest someone for us to chat with, we'd love to hear from you. Just drop us an email at info@pein.ie.